There are so many issues throughout all levels of government that smart Christians need to view it as a way to care for our neighbor by making good decisions.
Molly Hemingway talking about her joint presentation with her husband, Mark, at the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
The federal government has gotten much more involved in family formation or family destruction, abortion, other issues. And there are so many ways in which it's important for us to think about how we can defend the weak and vulnerable among us by making good decisions.
You can watch journalists Molly and Mark Hemingway making the case for Christian political engagement at this year's Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. The $135 registration fee includes the ability to watch a live stream and a recording. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be talking about a decision that I think, no legal expert here, but I think will prove to be both impactful but also very unwise on the part of the Supreme Court regarding the 1964 Civil Rights Act and LGBTQ discrimination. Joining us on this Monday afternoon, Carrie Severino. She's Judicial Crisis Network President, graduate of Harvard Law School, former law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and co-author of the book Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Court. Carrie, welcome back.
Good to be here.
How do you explain this 6-3 decision from the Supreme Court today?
Well, you know, this was a discouraging decision because it was really a very activist decision rewriting this law, the Civil Rights Act. And as Justice Alito put in his dissent, you know, there's just only one word for this. It's called legislation. They legislated from the bench, but it was masquerading as textualism. And that, I think, is almost as dangerous as the outcome of the decision itself, because it allowed these judges to, using textualist terminology and language, come to an outcome that is decidedly not textualist. If you're looking for the text of the statute, you have to interpret it as if it was originally understood, the original meaning. You can't redefine the terms as to what they might want to mean in 2020. We have to read the law as it was passed in 1964. And I don't think anyone's arguing that the legislators who passed the 1964 Civil Rights Act thought that it covered sexual orientation. They, in fact, debated that. They argued not to include that in the law, or even more so that it would have covered gender identity and transsexualism. That is something that was not even on the radar at the time. It wasn't even in the DSM, the psychological textbooks at the time. Sex change operations were not even done at the time. So the idea that that would have covered that range of discrimination law is totally antithetical to the notion that we look at the original meaning of the terms as passed by the legislators.
Why do you say that this hijacking of textualism is an ominous sign for anyone concerned about the future of representative democracy?
Yeah, so Justice Kavanaugh addressed this a little bit in his dissent, and he talked about how the concern is we have legislators who we elect democratically who represent us, and they're the ones who write the laws. If a legislator can write the law, pass the law based on what he or she understands it to mean 1 year, and then the next year, or 20 years, or 30 years down the road, judges can then say it means something different. You don't have your legislators, your representatives, making the laws anymore. Now what you have is judges making the laws. And because they're bringing into that meaning that never was intended by those people who were the constitutional agents who actually did pass those laws. There's many laws that we might want to update or change. It happens all the time. But that's the legislators who have to do that, and it should never be the judges who are doing it. It's even more outrageous when it happens on an issue that obviously is one of the most hotly contested and debated issues in America today.
Tell us about the two sets of cases that the court considered in this decision.
So they had to do with, actually, there are even three cases. Two of them had to do with sexual orientation and people who were fired, who claimed they had been fired for their jobs because of sexual orientation. Now, we don't have anyone that's conceding that was even the reason. That was what they were arguing in the cases, but we have to kind of take that as assumed based on how the cases were brought. Even if they were fired based on sexual orientation, is that legally prohibited? And then a second case that had to do with a funeral home run by a Christian man who had a worker there who was a man and then came to work at one point and said, feel like I'm a woman. I'm going to start dressing as a woman. I'm going to, you know, I want everyone to call me Amy, et cetera. And he said, I can't, you know, this isn't going to work. I can't have you here. This is not what I believe. And I think it's going to be upsetting to the people that I serve. You know, imagine the people he's dealing with and his clients are all grieving and at a difficult time in their families. To have that added to the mix, he felt was going to be inappropriate for his clients and customers. And that person was then fired as a result. So those are the two cases that were brought up. And in both sets of cases, they said, well, this isn't even covered by the discrimination law on the books, because the federal law says it's discrimination on the basis of sex, not on the basis of sexual orientation, not on the basis of gender identity. So in no case was anyone fired because they were male or because they were female. They were fired, or they were allegedly fired, because they were homosexual or because they were a man who was then dressing as a woman.
Justice Alito and Justice Thomas are saying that the majority of the court here have engaged in legislation in this decision. What do they mean?
Well, what they mean is, instead of interpreting the law as it's written, they were effectively changing the law. Changing the law is the job of a legislator, not the job of a judge. The judge's job is simply to interpret the law, whether or not they agree with it, whether or not they think it should be updated or changed, to say this is what the law means. And anytime you have judges, for whatever reason, even with the best intentions, who are changing the terms of that law, that's not the judicial role. That's legislation.
So what are the possible consequences of this decision?
Well, Justice Alito spelled out a lot of the worrisome trends that are going to be coming down the pike now as a result of this decision. His dissent, he went down just a litany of kinds of cases. I think there's going to be just a flood of cases coming before the Supreme Court. Things like bathrooms and locker rooms. Are people now going to be forced, all businesses across the board, be forced to open those to people of any sex? About First Amendment concerns with freedom of speech. You know, can jurisdictions like New York City already does fine people for using the wrong pronoun? Could you be in trouble if you use the wrong pronoun to an employee, the pronoun that they didn't approve of? Problems with First Amendment freedom of religion. You know, what about churches? What about mosques or synagogues and the people that they hire? Are they going to be forced, either in their churches or in their schools, then, to have people who are living a lifestyle that goes contrary to what they are teaching and, you know, training the students in class, that one lesson, and then having, you know, other employees of the school who are teaching a very different thing to their lifestyle? You have questions with women's sports. If this interpretation of because of the discrimination because of sex continues, does that mean that all women's sports are effectively going to be gutted, because you will have to allow men who claim to be women to participate in these sports? And you know, it's simply biologically true that the men are going to have an advantage at those sports, and women aren't going to be able to compete fairly in those situations. So, the list goes on and on. The Hobby Lobby type cases, where now the Supreme Court has said religious, not even just churches themselves, but religious business owners should not be forced to pay for abortion, to pay for abortifacient contraceptives for their employees. Could they then, though, be forced to pay for transgender surgeries or hormones for their employees? I think that is clearly a case that's going to come down the pike, and we don't yet know what the Supreme Court is going to say about that balance. So it's going to trigger a flood of new cases. It's just more indication that what's going on here is not something that was the interpretation of the law that's always been there, because you'll be triggering so many new questions precisely because this is a new thing in the law. If you had had this happen in the legislative process, it would have, these kinds of questions would have been dealt with. There would have probably been compromises come to as to how to balance the interests of, say, religious freedom or the rights of employers in these cases. That's not what happens when a court steps in and does it all by itself. Then what you have is this just sort of broad, one-size-fits-all declaration. And now the courts are going to be spending years, I would predict, cleaning up what that really means practically.
Justice Gorsuch, who joined the majority, has said that the ruling is narrow and that Title VII and other federal laws already include protection for religious employers. How do you respond to that?
Well, there are some protections there. I mean, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, I would think, should still apply. That's the one that the court relied on in the Hobby Lobby case. However, we don't actually know how the courts are going to balance those questions. And we also know that we've seen, while the Supreme Court has typically been fairly good on religious freedom, we've seen a lot of the lower courts who have not struck those balances, I think, in the way that respects the First Amendment or that gives religious freedom its due as required by the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And the truth of the matter is upwards of 99% of cases end at those lower levels of the court. So I think there's a lot of people who are going to be very concerned about whether their businesses can even continue, whether they continue to operate in consistency with their own religious beliefs following this decision.
Justice Kavanaugh, who joined the minority, wrote, "To think that sexual orientation discrimination is just a form of sexual discrimination is not just a mistake of language and psychology, but also a mistake of history and sociology." What does he mean?
Well, he gave the example of, you know, look, Seneca Falls is not the same as Stonewall. This is not, there's a very different movements we're talking about, the women's liberation movement, very different effect than the LGBT movement. It's just an error to say this, that discrimination on the basis of sex is the same thing as discrimination based on sexual orientation. They've had very different historical patterns in the nation. Many people may subscribe to both, but they are entirely different, just conceptually, events that have happened.
So what have we learned about President Trump's two appointees who fall on opposite sides of this decision in the court's recent ideas?
Well, I think, unfortunately, though they both claim to be textualists and originalists, and I think Justice Gorsuch, the vast majority of the time, does operate on that front. He's overwhelmingly agrees with Justice Thomas, for example. I think the court's leading originalist in most decisions. However, I think he got it wrong in this case. Justice Kavanaugh, I think, got it not just right, but did some excellent work in explaining some of the errors that Gorsuch fell into. He almost called it a literalist view of textualism. Like, you could take the word sex out of context and say, well, this has something to do with sex because homosexuality has to do with sex or transgender has to do with sex. So therefore, it must be discrimination on the basis of sex. And he talked about how important it is to take words in context. On the basis of sex means something very different than just does it have anything to do with sex. And he gave some, I think, helpful examples of things that if you just took the words separately, for example, you could say the American flag could mean any flag produced in America, for example. Oh, it's an American flag because it was made in the USA. But when we say the American flag, we mean the stars and stripes. We mean our particular flag. He said a three-pointer could be referring to a football field goal because you get 3 points for it. But obviously, when you say the words a three-pointer in context, everybody knows that means a basketball shot from outside of the three-point line. So he just was underscoring how you can't have a rigid, like, look up the dictionary definition of each word and then put them back together structure. You have to be able to read the statutes in context with an understanding of the usage of the English language at the time, and that's how you do textualism.
Had the court's majority really been engaged in textualism, genuine textualism, what would they have decided?
Well, I think there is only one clear result in this if you're looking at textualism, and that is simply to say that the statute doesn't cover sexual orientation or gender identity discrimination. A lot of states have come to the conclusion that they want to add that to their statute. So they started out having discrimination on the basis of sex, and then 21 states have added sexual orientation or transgender status. That's an option that legislatures have, and they've recognized there's a difference. If the court was doing textualism properly, they would have recognized this is a different thing that we're talking about, that discrimination on the basis of sex means discrimination because you are a man or because you are a woman, and treating one sex as a class differently than the other. It's not something that just, if it involves sex in any way, is discrimination. That would incorporate things, and Justice Alito talks about this, like if you fired someone because of their propensity towards sexual harassment. Well, that has to do with sex, certainly, but that's certainly not discrimination on the basis of sex. So we have to read these words understanding, you know, the way they are used in language and not in a rigid literalist way.
The 1964 Civil Rights Act, signed by President Johnson, is considered the crowning legislative achievement of the civil rights era. Has it, in effect, been turned by the court's majority into a SOGI law today?
Oh, absolutely. And that's, again, not at all what the law was intended to be at the time. And legislatures starting from immediately when it was passed and for decades since, have recognized it doesn't cover this. There have been multiple attempts to add SOGI language, sexual orientation, gender identity language, to that law. They have not yet succeeded, although many have suggested that they probably, the trend line is that they would have succeeded legislatively within the relatively near future if the court had not jumped in and cut that process off. And you saw also, you know, lots of courts, the courts for decades, no court said this covered sexual orientation. And then suddenly we saw a sea change very recently. You saw the Supreme Court even, and then this is something that I believe it was Justice Kavanaugh who pointed out, that the Supreme Court has addressed lots of times issues of sexual orientation. And even when they have ruled in favor in cases like Obergefell with the same-sex marriage decision or in Lawrence versus Texas outlawing anti-sodomy laws, they didn't ever appeal to discrimination on the basis of sex, and that would have been a much easier argument. So we have had 19 Supreme Court justices, including many of the ones who were on this case, who ruled in favor of LGBT issues, but never considered that it was part of discrimination on the basis of sex. So it's just, it's hard to imagine that this really is an interpretation that's faithful to what discrimination on the basis of sex really meant. It did, in fact, turn that statute completely on its head and really reinterpret a major provision in it.
Should he be elected, Vice President Biden has very strongly vowed to support the Equality Act. What does this court decision portend about a future court challenge to that act?
Oh, well, I think what we see, unfortunately, is, you know, a court that in many ways is willing to go along with whatever the predominant social movement is. I hope that wasn't the motivating factor for justices like Gorsuch. I hope that it was simply a misunderstanding of how to apply textualism in this case, and because overwhelmingly he has been making good decisions on that thing. However, I think we certainly can see that that's the direction that the court unfortunately has gone. There are also increasing attempts that we see from the left to intimidate justices of the court to say, if you're not going to agree with decisions that, you know, rule our way on these major social issues, on major hot-button political issues, then we're going to make things difficult for you. We're going to threaten the legitimacy of the court. We're going to threaten to pack the court with more justices. Unfortunately, I think there are reasons to be concerned that that could be having an effect on the court. And we certainly know that if Joe Biden were president and had the opportunity to appoint a Supreme Court justice, there's no question the kind of person he would put on the court would be someone who would have been happy to make this conclusion in this case. And I'm not even sure it would be someone who would have needed to find a textualist fig leaf in order to do so. What we've seen time and again is that the liberal nominees to the court are more than willing to time and again come up with the liberal policy outcome that they favor in the name of whatever, you know, and whatever the legal question is, it almost doesn't matter if they will get to the right political result that the liberals favor. And I think that's what you would absolutely see out of a Biden Supreme Court pick.
Carrie Severino is Judicial Crisis Network president, a graduate of Harvard Law School, a former law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and co-author of the book Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Court. You can purchase Justice on Trial and learn more about the Judicial Crisis Network at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Carrie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
The Simply Classical curriculum for special needs moves at my child's pace and gives her exactly what she needs. So writes Amber, a homeschooling mother who has joined thousands in homes and schools teaching from this uniquely Christian classical approach to special education. Teach students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome based on ability level rather than chronological age. Use promo code LPR20 today at classicalspecialneeds.com. classicalspecialneeds.com.
Since 1978, Lutheran Church Extension Fund has had the humble privilege of supporting Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Ministries and her workers. Thanks to faithful investors, LCEF has provided thousands of church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations with the low-cost loans and resources they need to reach more people with the saving name of Christ. To learn more, visit lcef.org or call 800-843-5233, 800-843-5233.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University Chicago, with a message for parents, grandparents, and godparents of college-bound children. Concordia Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're devoted to our Lutheran confession and committed to strong academics. Please encourage your child, grandchild, or godchild to check out Concordia University Chicago at cuchicago.edu.
Our life together as the church after COVID-19 will bring new challenges. For example, we might be tempted to skip the regular gathering of God's people because we're more comfortable streaming it on Facebook instead. May it not be. Join the Reverend Dr. Mark Wood as he explores this theme in his article for the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness titled, Gathering Again, It Will Not Be the Same. Subscribe at cph.org/witness, The Lutheran Witness, Interpreting the Contemporary World from a Lutheran Perspective, cph.org/witness.